This is KBLULP in Logan. My name is Richard Island Blake, and I would like to thank you all for tuning in to Baladishinish, or Folklore Now. And I especially appreciate all of you who have continued to tune into these episodes of mine of the podcast from the beginning. So in case you haven't noticed, I do just love ghost stories. In fact, that is one of the areas in which I am doing most of my research. Some of them deal with ghosts at sea, as you've noticed with a couple stories that I've talked about. But also, there are ghosts just about anywhere that you can think of to look for anything. And there are even some ghosts that are actually said to inhabit this campus, Utah State University's campus here in Logan. And as a folklorist, I love to talk to other people who have similar interests as me. And so I would actually encourage any of you to go and seek out these stories that are about the campus and about ghosts here. There are some faculty here in the folklore program who could tell you a great deal about them, but there's one story in particular that I want to talk to you about, and that is the ghost of a woman who, in the Old Main Hill building many, many moons ago, she was practicing the piano in preparation to play at the prom. For some reason, she actually died before she got a chance to do that performance. And those people had to end up getting somebody else to play the piano. As a result, one can say that it is because of this mischance that the ghost actually still resides in the Old Main Hill building up by the bell tower. And there you can still hear that piano playing at night if you happen to be in Old Main Hill at night, up near where the rafters were. On a special night, you might be able to go in there and hear her playing the piano. I have not personally experienced that yet. Maybe one day, though, I can possibly sneak into that building at night after everything's locked up and find out if I truly hear what is purported to be up there. So, just to start things out with that story, then, I do have a couple other things that I just want to talk about here before I go to the other guests that I have interviewed who are in the folklore program to talk to them about their folklore experiences, because we all love to talk about what we do and why we do it. Last time we talked to Rachel Ross, who was doing research into her area of interest in the folklore program. Just recently, a couple exciting things have happened in the folklore realm, and that would be there have been two conferences of collections of folklorists who get together to talk about what they're researching and what their interests are, and just to interact as folklorists. One of them was the Folklore Society of Utah meeting that took place in November. We all met in Ephraim on that time, and we discussed a lot of the research that we were doing. And this kind of conference is pretty much a laid-back affair. But hearing about all of the things that people are interested in and where they have brought their own particular folklore passions is always fun to hear about, especially others who have their own podcasts dealing with stories. One particular thing that we talked about, or that was talked about by a faculty member at Utah State University who happened to be there, it's Lynn McNeil, who's with the folklore program, and she talked to us about Barry Tolkien, who was a teacher here in the folklore program until, you know, well, he stopped teaching here a while ago, but people continued to talk to him and spend time with him discussing things or singing along with him at special events. He passed away recently, and there was a memorial that was given for him at this particular conference and talking about him. And I thought that was a great thing to hear about, when I got here to Utah State University, Barry Tolkien was no longer with us. And since I am doing research into ghosts and music, he would have been a great person to talk to about it. But his memory is going to continue to live on here at Utah State University. And I hope you all appreciate those teachers who you grow attached to, that you do not forget them, and that you may continue to talk to them and communicate with them. And the other conference that I attended was in Buffalo. It was the American Folklore Society. And here, people from all over the country, folklorists from all over the United States, come together to present the work that they've done. And I actually presented at both of these conferences. But the one in Buffalo, there were just so many people talking about interesting things, whether it's architecture, whether it's particular cultural activities, events that they're researching. It all just is great to hear them talk about what it is that they're researching. And there were even people who had come from India and from China, and some people from Canada. That, of course, is not too far afield for people to travel in order to go to a conference, of course. But those people who keep coming from India, I just have to admire their tenacity in coming to these events. It's in a different town every year. This time it has to be Buffalo. And now that was my first time that I've ever visited the state of New York, let alone the city of Buffalo. Every new area has its own surroundings that give it its own atmosphere. And Buffalo is definitely different from any other atmosphere that I've been in. Now, having talked about these things, basically I wanted to let everyone out there know that folklorists, there are a lot of things that we do, and there are a lot of events that we get together for. Now that I have introduced all that, there are three people in the folklore program, three graduate students in the folklore program, who I have interviewed, and whose interviews that I want to play for you. As each of them tells you what it is they're studying, remember what Rachel was talking about along with what they're talking about, and you can truly appreciate what it is people can get passionate about with folklore. It is sometimes things you just least suspect. Keep that in mind as you listen to these interviews. Afterwards, I will do my closing. Being the time of year it is, there is a closing song that I'm going to be doing, but I will bring that up once I'm done with the interviews with Camille, Shelley, and Daisy. This is Bailet Ish Inish, or Folklore Now. We'd like to welcome you back to the show. And I'm here today with Daisy Allstone, and she's here to discuss her research that she has done here in her graduate work on the Tasmanian tiger. We'll start by asking her, so what is exactly is it that you're trying to discover about the Tasmanian tiger?
I'm not sure I'm trying to discover anything particular, but rather I'm studying the relationship between legends and endangered species. So the Tasmanian tiger is an animal that went extinct in 1936, and primarily that extinction was caused by human influence over hunting. There were legends that were told about the Tasmanian tiger as though it were sort of a vampire-like sheep killer, which justified the government placing a bounty for thylacine skins or Tasmanian tiger skins. And this led to the extinction, as I said previously. Now, what's interesting is that people today still see the Tasmanian tiger around both on Tasmania itself as well as mainland Australia. And the legends around the Tasmanian tiger have shifted from this vampire-like sheep killer to one that's much more kind-hearted and good-natured, almost like a dog, rather, a man's best friend that was taken from us too soon. So I am studying the relationship between shifting legends and how we can potentially use them to help conservation efforts for wildlife in the future.
So the Tasmanian tiger is a symbol of conservation?
Certainly. It definitely in the early 20th century influenced a lot of conservation efforts and environmental protection policy on other animals that were slowly slipping into extinction as well. And that narrative is still generally used today, or it's at least a significant example in conservation narratives for a reason to conserve species and to protect the ones that we still have currently.
So where are you? Where has your research taken you so far?
A lot of my research has focused on both people who share these legends, so people who actively seek out finding Tasmanian tigers today in the wild, and the legends that they share, the information they share about the potential current existence of the species, as well as a lot of the folk art and material culture that people make embodying the Tasmanian tiger in this new narrative of this puppy dog or nice sort of animal that we regret to have killed. So I have spoken to artists and other travelers who, legend trippers as we call them in folklore studies, people who are trying to go seek out and then recreate a legend narrative for themselves through finding the Tasmanian tiger. So,
and most of these people are not native to Australia, or is it pretty much people from all over?
Most of them are native to Australia or Tasmania specifically, but many people make art about Tasmanian tigers in Western cultures who are not necessarily from Australia.
What brought you to studying this particular topic?
I've always been interested in animals in general, and particularly the ones that are unique or have some kind of intriguing story behind them. So the extinction of the Tasmanian tiger is definitely one of those. I also am interested in animals that have gone recently extinct for a number of different reasons. I like to know why species go extinct, how, is particularly considering climate change, they're more rapidly going extinct. And I find that this issue is really important for us today, especially in how we understand biodiversity and how important preserving current species that are still extant is to our ecosystems.
You have researched other animals that have gone extinct. Do a lot of people generally go looking for these extinct animals?
Not all of them, actually. The Tasmanian tiger is unique to somewhat in this aspect. People also look for passenger pigeons or other extinct animals like dodo birds occasionally as well. But I think the thing that's different about Tasmanian tigers is that it's very culture specific. So it's identified very strongly with the Tasmanian people. Passenger pigeons are like that to some extent, but people don't necessarily go around looking for mammoths, for example. They're quite large and have less of that mysterious quality to them that the elusive Tasmanian tiger sort of does.
And many of these species died out in living memory, pretty much.
A number of them have, yeah.
I probably should have asked this at the beginning, but what kind of an animal is the Tasmanian tiger?
The Tasmanian tiger is a marsupial, so it's not related to canines, although it sort of looks much like a wolf. It has a pouch that it used to carry its young in, and it walks on four legs, and it has about 16 stripes that go from its mid-back down to its tail.
So it's related to kangaroos?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And when did the Tasmanian tiger change from being something to be feared to something that needs to be preserved or admired?
Nearing extinction, when it was endangered, and then post-extinction.
For the internet, how were people pretty much going around talking about these things?
Well, a lot of articles were printed in local newspapers about Tasmanian tigers in Tasmania and in Australia, as scientific journals and books publications talked about them at length, particularly for their the fact that it was endangered. And then it is sort of unique. It's a good example of convergent evolution, where it has similar features to animals that it is genetically unrelated to. So like I mentioned earlier, it looks like a dog or a wolf, but is taxonomically very different. And this sort of raised awareness during the early 20th century. And then since then, it's mainly been people in Australia and Tasmania who have sought after the Tasmanian tiger in the wild. And then with the advent of the internet and particularly advances in technology like cloning or genetic modification, word spread about the Tasmanian tiger much more broadly and globally.
So is there a good deal of research that you see yourself doing that you haven't gotten around to yet?
I'm not sure what you mean in terms of
where
my...
Where do you plan on going next with your research?
Currently, I plan on actually visiting Tasmania. Up until this point, I have not had a chance to actually go to the island itself. So I would plan on doing ethnographic research, both through interviews as well as data collection in Tasmania itself.
What kind of people are you interviewing? Pretty much just the cryptozoologists, or are you going to get a big pool of different people with different ideas about the tiger?
Well, at this point, I've primarily been interviewing artists, people who make artwork that feature Tasmanian tigers as a primary element in their work. I've also interviewed people who, the legend trip, as I mentioned earlier, go out and seek the Tasmanian tiger out in the wild. But I also, if I get an opportunity to go to Tasmania, would love to talk with just some locals or people who strongly identify with the Tasmanian tiger, as it is such a everyday presence in the lives of Tasmanians and Australians.
So the Australians and Tasmanians themselves actually see this animal as an icon of theirs of some kind?
Well, it's all over the place in terms of advertisements. And, I mean, even they have a local beer company that's called the Tassie Tigers. Their cricket team is the Tassie Tigers. There's statues of Tasmanian tigers all over the place. It's on all the tourist brochures. It's pretty much everywhere in the common imagination of Tasmanians and Australians.
So what's like going to northern Scotland and seeing the Loch Ness Monster everywhere around Loch Ness? Not sure if you've been there.
I would say similar. I haven't been there, so I don't know for sure, but I would say it's something similar. Sort of like how Sasquatch is present in Oregon. I can speak to that at least.
Okay. Is there anything else that you'd like to add here before we go?
I'm not sure I have something else to add.
Not sure. All right. Well, thank you very much then for coming in and telling us about your research, and good luck with everything, and thanks for coming in.
Great. Thanks for having me.
All right. Listening to that, I, like everyone, I guess, to think before you heard Daisy there talking about it, how many of you out there had even heard of the Tasmanian tiger? Because I certainly hadn't until she had brought it up when I'd first met her. A lot of these types of things, many people, as I've said, don't always think about it until someone else brings it up. Now that we've done Daisy Allstone's interview, we are now going to be going on to the second interview that I have planned for us here today. So let's sit back and just listen to what Shelley Jones has to say. All right, I'd like to welcome you all back to Baelish and Ish, or Folklore Now. And I'm here with Shelley Jones. And she's going to explain to us what her research is on her project, which involves the Steven Universe that exists on Tumblr. Basically, what is Steven's Universe?
Okay, so Steven Universe is a children's show that is currently airing on Cartoon Network. And I'm really interested in the fandom surrounding Steven Universe. So there's a lot of different places where fandom can exist, but I'm specifically looking at Tumblr as well as Twitter. But my main focus is on Tumblr. And what I'm researching is internal antagonism within this fan community. So basically how fans mediate the different rules of what it means to be in the fandom and what they can or cannot do through basically harassing each other. So my case study focuses on someone called Zami070, who drew a very notorious piece of fan art portraying one of the characters in Steven Universe as a little bit skinnier than she is in the show. And this created a huge backlash in the community. So some people said, oh, this is fat shaming. You can't do this. This isn't canon. This is not how the character looks like. By drawing this character, then you're kind of insulting everyone in the fandom who believes you shouldn't body shame. Whereas other people in the fandom said that, well, it's fan art, so you can draw whatever you want. You can portray characters however you want. So I'm really looking at kind of what values this internal antagonism reveals in the community, as well as kind of what it reveals about how people need to kind of control and mediate their community.
So how old is this fandom, and when did this controversy start?
Let's see. The controversy, oh, I should know this. I think it was in 2015, October of 2015. That's when the fan art was posted. So that's kind of where the heart of the controversy was. Let's see. Steven Universe, I think, has been airing, I want to say, since like 2013, 2014. So it's kind of a young fandom, but it has been around for a relatively long time. Steven Universe is a show that kind of all the episodes come out really slowly, so the fandom has kind of stuck around, whereas for other fandoms where the show has ended, like Gravity Falls, is kind of a dead fandom. No one really posts in it anymore. So this one is kind of still around right now.
And is the controversy still going on right now?
So that's an interesting thing that you bring up. So there was there's revelations in the show where this character who had been portrayed as skinny by Zami was revealed to actually be skinny and had been shapeshifted into a more heavy form. So people kind of hearken back and they say, oh, Zami was right. This character is skinny. Like, she was right all along. Zami's like, please stop talking about this. But that's not really a controversy as much anymore. That's kind of an interesting after effect of this kind of battle in the fandom, is that a lot of people kind of either left the fandom for a little bit or they went to other platforms. So I know some people went to Instagram for their fandom rather than on Tumblr because they saw Tumblr as toxic.
So what do you mean that, oh, suddenly they realized they were skinny? How is that the person who created it, or is that?
So it was a revelation in the show. So the characters in the show, they're aliens and they can shapeshift. So a character who was portrayed from the very beginning as heavier, it turns out that she was actually like the equivalent of like a military space princess who was portrayed as skinnier. She was still very tall and a large person, but she was still a skinny person. So this is a canon show revelation.
Are all the characters shapeshifters then, or is that just decided on this one?
Sort of. So all the they all should maintain the ability, all the aliens, but there's a lot of humans in the show as well. So only some of them can shapeshift.
Did the fans or did the creators come up with this idea that they can shapeshift?
Oh, that's in the show. Yeah, that's an interesting part of the research, is it's all about this mediation of canon versus kind of fan interpretation. So it's like, is it okay to draw her as skinny because technically she should be able to shapeshift, or is that kind of betraying the message of the show?
And this understanding the creators had from the beginning, did the fans not understand it that way?
So this was a revelation that she was actually skinny, so they didn't, that was not known until like this year, but the shapeshifting aspect was known the whole time. So
when the skinny character showed up, no one really thought, well, she could be whatever she wanted.
Well, so people just assumed that she was, that was her natural form, was that she was heavier.
Okay, and where have you gone so far in this particular research of yours?
So I've done a lot of just kind of, I guess, digital field work where I just kind of gather stuff. There's a lot of, the internet loves to archive itself. So there are a lot of resources on there where I can just kind of go and find the information myself. I've also had the opportunity to interview some people at Comic-Con. I've interviewed several of my friends as well because they're part of the fandom. And it's kind of led me, originally I was just interested in how the community kind of governed itself, but it's kind of led me to be more interested in how modern day fandom is seen as opposed to how kind of earlier Star Trek fandom was seen. Because earlier then there wasn't really any like queer elements, or everyone was very like heteronormative and very, you know, beautiful, and they all kind of fit the same body type, for example. But nowadays in a lot of media, there's a lot more representation both of body types, of race, of kind of different LGBT aspects. And so it's interesting how fans receive this, because instead of queering the show, that queerness already exists, right? So it's kind of interesting how they kind of stick to the values already shown in the show and kind of try and figure out how the fandom should receive these kind of already representative aspects of the show. Like, should they be allowed to then take those representative aspects and make them less representative? Because that's what fandom has done. It's reinterpreted stuff. But is that allowed when that makes it kind of less diverse and less, I don't know, like less representative?
Due to the nature of fandoms, are there like spin-off fan arts or things that come out?
Yes, yeah. This? So this is an incredibly lush fandom. There's lots of things like fan art. There's fan fiction. There's people like making GIFs. There's lots of cosplay, which I cosplay myself. So I've done a few cosplays from the show, which has been fun. There's like song covers because the show is full of songs. Basically any iteration of like fan creation is present in this fandom. So lots of satire on itself, like people making fun of their own fandom. Lots of physical objects as well. So you can buy t-shirts, you can buy plushies, you can buy, they all have gems. They're space rock people. So they all have a gem and you can buy those gems for cosplay purposes. And yeah, so it's a very lush fandom.
Okay. Where do you see yourself going then with this particular research? What direction are you wanting to take it now?
So this is my thesis. So this example is only one chapter. So I'm also going to look at kind of the interaction between fans and the creators and kind of see how that is mediated, especially now that it's all happening on the internet, right? The boundaries between fan and creator are very thin, whereas before they were kind of unreachable, right? You couldn't just email or tweet at Gene Roddenberry, he would respond to you. But now you can, and people have. And there was an instance where they harassed a creator off of, I believe she was a storyboard artist, but they harassed her off of Twitter because she was doing something they didn't like, the fans didn't like. So that's going to be my next case study. And there are also a few instances of what was seen as racist kind of, what's it called? Oh, concept art, of racist concept art that people got really upset about, and they actually had to reprint the concept art book because people were so upset about this particular picture. So I'm really interested in looking at things like that. And then my last case study, I'm going to look at an instance in Taiwan where someone actually put needles in a cookie that they gave a fan artist they didn't like. And then the fan artist like put the cookie in their mouth. They didn't die or anything, but they definitely bled, right? They probably had to get a tetanus shot or something. It's in Chinese, so I haven't been able to kind of decipher all of it, but that was the gist. And I'm interested in looking at the reception of that for fans, because in the Zami case, and everyone still supported the harassment even after Zami announced that she was going to commit suicide. She didn't actually end up committing suicide, but she was admitted into the hospital for it. So it's interesting to see people saying, no, you can't physically assault someone by putting needles in their cookies, right? But you can harass someone to the point of them wanting to commit suicide, right? So they're both physical reactions, but one happens online, one happens offline, and they're received differently by fans. So that's kind of my last case study I'm going to look at.
Okay. And is there anything else that you'd like to add here then before we go?
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is kind of a relatively unstudied aspect of fan studies. A lot of fan studies are predominantly positive. I think because a lot of people studying fans are fans themselves. And I'm a fan myself, but I've seen kind of the vitriol that fandoms can get into. So I'm interested in kind of expanding on that. I also think it will be interesting to see how internal harassment functions as a way to kind of maintain community norms, as well as how the platform in which the fandom is on can influence the interactions and kind of how, or I guess the extent of the negativity that can be present.
Okay. All right, Shelley. Well, thank you for being here and good luck with your research then.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Shelley's research here in Steven's Universe fandom brings up another concept that we folklorists like to discuss occasionally, and it really exploded across the internet in some areas, and that is the idea of fandoms, and fan fiction, of course, is a part of that. Being a writer myself, I have also dabbled in the art of fan fiction. So this particular area is vast, and you would have to spend a lot of time going through all of it. We each have our interests, and that's our fandom that we would choose is what interests us the most. And on another episode of Bale Edition-ish, I will be talking to you about a few areas about fandoms and examples for you of fan fiction and different types of things people are fans of and how they acted upon. And that'll give you a general idea of how I see the fan fiction and fandom universe. I'd also like people to think about what it is they have studied in this particular area. I'm sure a lot of us have thought, gee, I can come up with a better episode than that, or I have a story that goes within that realm that I think will be better than those idiots have been throwing out there already. And maybe they would, maybe they won't, but there are outlets where you can find a lot of this kinds of fan fiction reactions of fandoms, and you can put them down for the whole world to see. These are websites where you can pretty much lay out for everybody what your ideas are. I am going to be going through a lot of this here in a later episode, but here right now, I just want to let you know about fandoms because of what Shelley is talking about, and contemplate maybe what it is that you think you might be able to come up with yourself. And if you think you've seen an episode of something and say, well, they should have done this or whatever, that could be one of those things that you could always write to me about and tell me what ideas you have about this folklore area and what you think of it. I do need to apologize about something, though. I did say earlier that I was going to be doing 3 interviews for this particular episode, but alas, I wasn't able to take advantage of an interview with her. We will be hearing from her later on another episode in another context, but the reason you don't hear her particular area of research is because she wasn't able to make it to do that particular interview. I'd like then to bring us back to the holiday season. It being Christmas time and this being the last podcast that I'll be doing before Christmas comes about, I want to play a song for you that really, I think, galvanizes what it is about the Christmas spirit. This is my favorite Christmas song. It is not in the English language, and so you won't understand a lot of it, but I hope you can appreciate the feeling you get or the kind of understanding that comes along with hearing this song. The song is called Un Stern, and there's at least a couple things that are in the Welsh language that I can quickly explain to you. The name of the song is Un Stern, and Un Stern means a star. The star, of course, that they're talking about is the Star of David that led the wise men to where Jesus was to be found. And another part of the song says in Bethlehem, which means in Bethlehem. So it talks about how the star led people to the city of Bethlehem to where Jesus was born. So I will be playing that after that song is done. I will have some final words. After that, I will say a few things to you before closing up the episode. And so here we go with Un Stern.
Darling, my friend. mein Japhet. Nach Natalik, mein Em, mein Predwes. Ach, mein Name, den ich rede, und ihn werde ich werde, an Hovia.
And now, with that wonderful song concluded, I will end this podcast by wishing everyone a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year, since, as I said, their next episode is going to come after the New Year, and I'm going to have a few interesting things to say about our calendar and about the New Year's, why we celebrate what we celebrate at those times. It will be really interesting, I believe, once you know where those things come from. So before we leave, I would like to encourage anyone who has something they'd like to hear about to reach out to me and let me know. As usual, my email is folklorenow33@gmail.com. That's the Bailadish Anish. That is the Bailadish Anish email address to send me anything you like me to share. And don't forget that folklore encompasses many things, and seeing the creative side of people is rarely a dull thing. So thank you so much for listening then, and have a nice evening.